documentary on News Talk.
Now on documentary on News Talk, producer Noel Sweeney brings to life the remarkable true tale of the enigmatic Dubliner Lawrence Carroll, who defied norms, embraced Buddhism, and faced down the British Empire in colonial Burma and Asia. This is Lawrence Carroll's Mindful Anarchy, Udamaloka, the Irish Buddhist of Rangoon.
In 1909, a saffron-robed, shaven-headed Irishman, based in Burma, now Myanmar, embarked on a riveting speaking tour of Ceylon, what we now call Sri Lanka. His message was clear. Colonial Britain is on the horizon, wielding Christian missionaries, aiming to dismantle your traditions, your way of life, and your Buddhism. They are armed with the Bible, the bottle, and the Gatling gun. He echoed this ominous warning throughout the island, capturing the attention of many.
They'll come for you with the Bible. They'll come for you with the whiskey bottle. They come for you with the Gatling gun.
In this documentary, I sit down with Lawrence Cox, Brian Bocking and Alicia Turner, the trio behind the book, The Irish Buddhist, The Forgotten Monk, Who Faced Down the British Empire. The three individuals at the forefront of resurrecting this nearly forgotten true tale of Lawrence Carroll, also known as Udamaloka. An Irish-born wanderer turned atheist Buddhist monk, Udamaloka navigated a maze of aliases, surveillance and even sedition charges. Yet amidst the intrigue, between 1900 and 1914, he forged deep connections with the people of Burma and beyond, tirelessly advocating against the oppression inflicted by Christian missionaries.
They say Ceylon was civilized by Christians who brought colorful coats, collars and hats and said, "What you were wearing is uncivilized. Wear these and become civilized."
There's so much polemic about it. You could imagine it's one of the early heavy metal tours, you know, in the Bible Belt in the US or whatever.
Meet Lawrence Cox, a distinguished professor of sociology at Maynooth University in Ireland. His journey into the enigmatic world of Udamaloka began during his extensive research on Buddhism in Ireland.
It's a huge moral panic. So the colonial press, the missionary press, they're outraged. They start having their competing lecture series side by side with Damalokas. Yeah, they send people into the talks, drumming on kind of tom-tom drums or giving out leaflets or whatever. It's very conflictual. They have police watching him. They get the law changed so that he can't do outdoor preaching. And the reason they do this, of course, is that he is attracting huge audiences for this message of they'll come for you with the Bible.
They'll come for you with the whiskey bottle. They come for you, for us, with the Gatling gun. And they praise three-star brandy, beehive brandy and white horse whiskey. They scheme to send whatever little money the gullible Sinhalese have got back to their own country. What can you say about the civilization you get from drinking alcohol? And they're doing the same in Singapore and Malaysia and anywhere else where the British government is. India, Burma.
The next year, he's back in Burma. He does another one of these talks in a place called Mulmain in southeast Burma. And suddenly he's on trial for sedition. It's nothing he hasn't said before. It's nothing he hasn't said before in Burma. But this time there's a trial. They've decided, okay, we've got to stop this guy now. He's becoming too dangerous, too big. What happens in Mulmain is there is so much popular support for him that they actually have to postpone the trial. And then they fill the streets with soldiers, there's armed cops in the courtroom, they have the trial, they convict him, and then of course there is an appeal which happens in Rangoon, in the capital.
Later in the documentary, we'll be returning to his trial for sedition. But perhaps for now, a more prominent question is, how did the tale of an Irishman, a Buddhist monk, stirring unrest among British colonials in Burma, fit into obscurity, particularly at a time when Ireland had its own turbulent struggles with the same colonial powers?
The story for 100 years had been that an English guy called Alan Bennett, or Alan MacGregor Bennett, had gone to Burma and had been ordained in 1902 and his ordination name was Ananda Metteya.
Now let's meet Brian Bocking, Professor Emeritus, specialising in the study of religions at University College Cork. It was during his exploration of subjects relevant to the Irish populace that he stumbled upon the intriguing figure of Udha Moloka. Bringing together the trio of authors, he sparked a collaborative effort that spanned a decade in the quest to unravel the mysteries surrounding this captivating figure of Irish history.
And we knew that Udha Moloka had been ordained in 1900. And it was obvious that while Ananda Metteya was very famous and everyone knew about him who studied modern Buddhist history, nobody had heard of Udha Moloka. And so clearly there was something wrong with the history. There was nothing wrong with what had happened, but there was something wrong with the way it had all been remembered, or in Udha Moloka's case, forgotten.
Holy Catholic Ireland might have been okay with an Irishman who was part of the struggle against the British Empire somewhere else. Certainly there was a lot of sympathy for that. But not if it meant converting to a different religion, and especially not if it meant actively challenging Christian missionaries, the same Christian missionaries that were being sent out from Maynooth. That would not go down well. But also in Burma, independent Burma from 1948 on, the main ethnic group, the Bamars, did not really want to know about this Irish Buddhist who was friends with all these ethnic minorities and connected across different parts of Asia. It didn't fit the story of a pure Burman Buddhism against the world. Ananda Metteya was very convenient because he was a gentleman and a scholar. And the trouble with Udha Moloka was that he wasn't either of those. And he was not a friend of the British Empire. And neither of those went down too well with the people who told us the stories about how did Buddhism come to the West.
What propelled us to follow it through was the fact we hadn't just discovered the name of a guy who became a Burmese Buddhist monk, but we discovered someone who clearly had made an impact, who was corresponding with, you know, newspapers and journals in different parts of the world, who was causing, you know, quite a lot of mayhem in Rangoon, you know, for the colonial authorities by asserting the rights of Buddhists to have their religion respected. This was completely unknown.
Missionary Christianity was telling people in Southeast Asia that their culture, their religion, their values were wrong, and that they needed to abandon those because it was only Europeans who knew what was right.
Allow me to introduce Alicia Turner, Associate Professor of Humanities at York University, Toronto. Her deep dive into colonial Burma's Buddhist history led her to the discovery of Udha Moloka. Through her research, she sheds light on the universal resonance of a central message.
So the Bible, for sure. The bottle, he sees a set of changes in the values and sort of moral practices that are happening in Burma, and he thinks that he sees them as being a pretty big threat. You got to remember, this is British colonialism. Not only was large amounts of alcohol publicly available under the British, it was licensed, and they were making quite a bit of money off the licensing of it. And it wasn't necessarily a habit that many Burmese people had before that. And again, he's not as explicit about opium, but there's a large opium trade going on. And he is deeply opposed to opium. They make an awful lot of money to keep themselves afloat off keeping people addicted and the trade and the commodity of opium. So this cultural sets of changes, you know, with the question of the bottle, are certainly part of where he's meaning to go to both the cultural and the economic heart of empire. His temperance organizing, his working against alcohol and working for temperance, he would partner with Christian organizations. So he partnered with a priest in Bangkok, and he was part of the International Order of Good Templars, which was mainly Christian. And so he worked with Christians in the kinds of social movements that he wanted to be a part of. He had a problem with missionary Christianity. And then his threat about the Gatling gun, you know, he's saying the British come with a Gatling gun. This is their threat. This isn't abstract to anybody in Burma. People knew what the violence of colonialism was because it was not in any regard abstract. It was known that the British would put down uprisings, would conquer groups, and the police repression was particularly high at that time as well.
In 1900, the year Lawrence Carroll took full ordination to become Udamaloka, Buddhist monks in Burma were at the early stages of pushing back against colonial powers, who believed they were bringing the gospel to these heathen. But with a lively Irishman in their midst, they hoped to bolster their efforts in what was deemed a critical time for a Buddhist revival across Asia.
We know that he took full ordination in 1900, and he says he felt that he could do something for his Buddhist friends as a European that perhaps they weren't able to do, but that they really wanted to do, but they didn't have the leverage because they were the colonized, as it were. So as someone who was kind of between those two worlds and totally committed to their cause, he was able to sort of say things and do things which would have been almost impossible for a Burmese monk.
There is a newspaper announcement about his ordination. It's a big, big show. So there are, I think, 100 monks in attendance. There are gifts to the monks. There is food provided. And among the monks who are officiating, there are some from his own monastery, but there are also some of the most senior monks in the Burmese hierarchy.
Little is known about the 25 years Udamaloka spent in the US prior to arriving in Burma. Being such a naturally outspoken activist and campaigner for the rights of Buddhists, it is assumed that much of that time was spent fighting for the rights of his fellow migrant workers.
He was what people used to call unschooled, but not uneducated. In other words, he was intelligent, he was enterprising, he was an avid reader, that's clear, and he was a tremendous speaker. But he'd come to his own very strong views through reading a wide variety of literature before he came to Asia. And then when he encountered Buddhism, he was able to apply that understanding to his Buddhism. And he realized, and the Buddhists around him in Burma certainly did encourage him, that he could articulate the problems that the Buddhists were experiencing in Burma, and he could campaign for the solutions that they sought.
Saying the British had taken Burma from the Burmans and that they had tried to trample on their religion was a quote often attributed to Udamaloka. But to speak against the crown in this way could be treated as treason. Nonetheless, he deftly criticised colonial missionaries and their agenda to dilute Burmese culture.
Damaloka is a Buddhist, but he's also an atheist. And that seems weird to us today because we kind of think, oh, all religions are basically faiths and they all basically believe in gods. This is a context of empire, right? An empire comes and colonizes Asia. And part of the justification for that is to say, we're bringing civilization. But then they also say, we're bringing the good news, we're bringing the gospel. And what Damaloka does is he takes all these atheist arguments and he uses them against Christian missionaries. And Damaloka is going around going, let me tell you about this Bible of yours. And he knows it backwards. He really knows the argument. He's almost certainly an atheist before he is a Buddhist.
In 1900, the majority of people in Burma would have been Buddhists. The census of 1911 says about 85%, with about 3 to 4% Hindu and 3 to 4% Muslim, and about 2% Christian, and the others animists or locals. But what that doesn't convey is the colonial conditions under which Buddhism and Burmese Buddhists in particular were facing at that time period. The British had been there since 1824 in parts, but really had only overthrown the Burmese monarchy in 1885, so about 15 years earlier. With it, at all the technologies, but also foreign domination and the presence of colonialism, quite a bit of war and insurgency, and then all sorts of other changes, changes in school systems. In the past, most boys would have been educated in a Buddhist monastery. Now they're being educated in government schools. Changes in morals and questions, new things like more drinking, more gambling. He's coming in which there's a lot of change, a lot of feeling that the changes that have come with recent colonialism are a problem and are a threat, and that they're a threat to Buddhism.
In the heart of Rangoon, at the revered Shwedagon Pagoda, history unfolded. Just 1 year after his ordination, Uda Maloka sparked a quiet rebellion that rippled through Burma's fight for independence.
In 1901, there is the full moon festival happening at the Shwedagon. Now, the Shwedagon is this enormous gold-plated pagoda in Rangoon. It is the biggest pilgrimage site for Buddhists in Burma. And the full moon festival is the biggest festival of the year. So the place is mobbed. And right in the middle of this, this is 1901, just a year after he's been ordained, Damaloka steps out in front of this off-duty policeman.
Where are you going, sir?
And says, take off your shoes.
We see you're wearing shoes. You're at the Shwedagon Pagoda, the highest place in Burma of the Buddha's blessed religion. You can't wear your shoes in here. You have to take them off.
1919, it had become customary to go barefoot at pagodas, a small act with big implications. Yet while this tradition took hold, a larger movement against British rule simmered beneath the surface. So while the rule on shoes might seem trivial, it was a silent protest echoing louder calls for freedom against British rule.
And this becomes a huge political issue, because he's found that one point where there is no official justification, you know, for casual tourists being on pagodas wearing shoes. But everybody knows they're not going to take their shoes off. That's really awkward for the colonial powers. There's no way they're going to tell people you've got to take your shoes off coming onto pagodas, because that would be unpicking this whole racial colour line that they're trying to create. But they also can't say, actually, do you know what? It doesn't matter. There's no need to show respect to native religion. So that's what Damaloka does. And that's one of the things that makes him a celebrity, is he finds this issue and the empire's like, don't know what to do about this.
It is believed that Carroll was born in Booterstown, County Dublin in 1856 and leaves Ireland around 1870. For the next 25 years, his path leads him west across the United States, toiling on boats, traversing land, and possibly engaging in the political struggles of the day. But how does an Irishman find himself in the midst of the exotic landscapes of Burma, embracing Buddhism, and eventually becoming a monk?
There's a possibility that he's kicked off the ship, so he works backwards and forwards, according to himself, but it seems very likely, on the Trans-Pacific liners. They go from San Francisco to Yokohama in Japan. And that's a possibility that he's kicked off the ship there for drinking and fighting.
The story is that he sort of fetched up in Burma. He got a job as a tallyman, which is someone who counts the cargo in and out of ships and so on in Rangoon Harbour. And he sort of got to know Buddhists and he was drawn to it. And we think he very probably, well, we know he had a problem with drink. He was possibly, you know, what we'd now call a recovering alcoholic. And Buddhism, you know, as you know, well, at least in Burma, you know, forbade drink. So that would have been a support to him. But he was just drawn to the Buddhist way of life. And he used to go along to the monastery. And I think he might have ended up living in the monastery. And eventually, at some point, he decided he was going to become a monk.
We just wanted to study the Buddhist doctrine. But I was not initially thinking of entering a monastery or anything like that. But when I went to Burma, we was deeply moved by the really good conduct and the purity of the monks there. So it occurred to me to enter a monastery, become a devout follower, and I finally became a real monk.
In his performance of daily life as a monk, he was very much acculturated. He knew how to hold himself, how to walk barefoot and collect alms, which was surprising to see in this European there in the midst of Burmese folks. He knew how to walk the walk. He knew how to be there, and Burmese people respected him for that. But when he got up to preach, when he got in front of the crowd and began preaching, he was not so familiar. And he would say things like, there are plenty of monks who can tell you about the Buddha's Dhamma, who can teach you the teachings. I'm not going to tell you that. These people, and I think respectfully, he would say, the Burmese monks can do a much better job at that. What I can tell you about is the ways in which British colonialism is threatening us, the ways in which the advent of imperialism, the ways in which the British are the threat to Buddhism and to Burma, and why you need to organize to save Buddhism to oppose the British. But when he'd get up, he'd be not particularly reserved, not particularly quiet, as would have been expected by a Burmese monastic at that time. Dhammaloka was very much in support and good for, supportive of the movement that was gelling around him in Burma for defense of Buddhism, that a few decades later would become an anti-colonial nationalism. And he really presages a lot of the anti-colonial work that's going to happen that does eventually drive out the British. And I think in that, he was very much good. I think he was helpful to young Buddhists trying to think about how you oppose authoritarianism and imperialism and how you do it from a Buddhist perspective. He lived in a way that the people around him, who would be the experts, recognized him as a real Buddhist monk. But we get a lot of people saying, well, you know, him and the other European, the other white Buddhists of that era, especially the other working class beachcomber Buddhist men who ordained as Buddhists, maybe they were just doing it just for a free meal, just maybe they were doing it just for a place to live. A couple of things. It's a really fascinating life to think about being working class Irish in the British Empire, to think about what it would mean to be in Asia as part of the British Empire, but to really be a poor white in Asia, in the sense that they didn't make any money. There was no one offering them a free trip home. Many of the men like Dhammaloka actually were much more affiliated with local cultures. And much more engaged with what was happening locally. Whether they were doing it for a free lunch or not, I think Buddhism came to shape them as much as they were taking anything from it.
If Ifua Dhammaloka, an Irishman, could embody the essence of Burmese monks, how does Buddhism thrive in today's Ireland? According to the latest Irish census data from 2022, around 9,000 individuals officially identify as Buddhist. The Sunyata Buddhist Centre in County Clare is deeply immersed in the Theravada tradition of Buddhism, the same lineage as Ifua Dhammaloka. Here I sit down with Imrani Karul, a member of the centre, who describes the dynamic landscape of Buddhist practice in today's Ireland. She also unveils a fascinating project involving Pali texts and the Irish language, offering a unique glimpse into Ireland's diverse spiritual journey.
So the bell is basically signalling the start of the afternoon meditation session, because it's a silent retreat. So, you know, they'd use a bell. It sounds a lot nicer than a school bell. I think it's meant to be a bit gentler. Usually we might do this, we could chat in the meditation hall or up in the dining area, but because of the retreat, we're gonna go up towards kind of the forest area to Akuti, which is it's like a meditation cabin. But it's a little bit secluded.
So we can just step in here.
What's quite interesting, if we think of this term Irish Buddhist, is that in fact, a lot of people in Ireland today who are maybe using Buddhist practices are not necessarily identifying as Buddhist. You know, this can range from, you know, of course, this term mindfulness we hear about, it actually comes from the Buddhist tradition, and similar to like yoga is based, maybe originally it came out of the yogic traditions of India and Hinduism, but now it's kind of been secularized in a certain way. So we have people who are coming from that approach all the way to people who are really engaged with, say, Buddhist philosophy, a Buddhist approach to, say, thinking about human psychology or even social issues and approaches to daily tasks, and are deeply engaging with that. But if you ask them, and if you came here and asked a few people, many would say, yes, like I am a Buddhist. And many would actually say, I don't know. No, I'm actually Catholic. And they might still be engaging in their Catholic faith, but also maybe engaging in a meditation practice and in Buddhist approaches. So I think this is quite a sort of interesting. A number of years ago, the manager of the center asked if I would be interested in translating some of the Buddhist texts into Irish, and he felt that it was quite important, you know, for a place which is based in Ireland, that it's also acknowledging, you know, let's say Ireland's cultural identity. So in one, and there's many ways to do that, of course, but one being to engage with the Irish language. So for me, as you know, I grew up speaking Irish, so he asked if I'd be interested in doing that. So at the moment, there is a group of us who are slowly but surely working on translating some Buddhist teachings, Buddhist texts, Buddhist chants into Irish, even just to hear what they sound like in the Irish language, and to kind of situate them in the Irish context is quite interesting. It's been an enjoyable project and also quite challenging, because you can imagine a lot of the terms when you're reading a Buddhist text, you know, like you come across words like karma, for instance, and it's very hard to translate, because obviously, you know, our Irish equivalent of the word karma. So you kind of have these questions, well, maybe we just leave it, because I think most people in the West anyway know what that word means, or to some degree they've heard of it. So whether you leave it or you try to find another translation. And then a lot of words which might be associated with any kind of spiritual or contemplative practice in Irish are, of course, the ones that you hear a lot in Christian contexts. So that's actually quite a nice thing. And it's nice to have that connection. But at the same time, it can lead to maybe misinterpretation and confusion. So because the word is not necessarily maybe what's being described in a Buddhist context, as compared to, you know, in a Christian or Catholic context. So there's been these kind of interesting debates that we've had to have.
Back in the realm of Udamaloka, a fateful encounter occurred while crossing the Ganges during his travels in India in 1905. A chance meeting with travel writer Harry Frank and a spirited debate with a Christian missionary inadvertently spread the word of this Irish Buddhist's endeavours across the globe.
Frank and his hobo mates really check out Damaloka. You know, so they're asking all these questions about different places he's been.
"2 years after landing in the States, we hit California and took a job trucking on the Blessed Fruit boat in the Sacramento River, the Acme."
Seemingly they've worked on the same boats on the Sacramento River.
"Bless my eyes, where are you now? 'Tis a blessed small world."
Damaloka tells him a chunk of his life story.
"'Twas on the Acme that I picked up with a blessed old sea dog by the name of Blodgett. And we shipped out of Frisco for Japan. Blodgett, poor boy, died on the voyage. And after paying off, I went on alone, fetching up at last in Rangoon. The natives were glad to see me, and I lived fine. But best of all, I found the true religion, as you would call it, or philosophy, as it should be called. Listen, up to the day of my confirmation, I was drawing 100 rupees a month. I quit my job. I gave every blessed thing I owned to a friend of mine, even me socks. If I'd put on European clothes again, for even one day, I'd be expelled. I cut off me hair and as fine a moustache as you ever saw. 'Twas hard, the first months, eating nothing but curry and rice. Now, bless you, I'd not eat European food if it was set down in front of me. Every blessed afternoon I studied the history of Buddha and Burmese with the old priest. Was a fine thing for me. After 5 years I started my ordination, being a novice. Then spent 5 years teaching the other novices and the children, the Tavoy Monastery being the big school of Rangoon, and was made an elder. Then, after 15 years, a bishop, the bishop as you would call him, of Rangoon. We've been a bishop for 6 years nearly."
Frank is fascinated. He gets all of this down. And then Frank watches Damaloka in action, because most of the people on this ferry are Burmese. But there's an Indian who has become a Christian, is going around giving out Christian pamphlets. And this Indian Christian runs into this Irish Buddhist.
"As you see, I'm a Buddhist priest."
And he's like, "Where are you from?" And Damaloka says, "I'm Irish."
"I am from Ireland."
And he says, "Well, if you're Irish, then you're Christian."
"Yeah, that's what the Christian fakers tell you."
Yeah, because all sahibs, all white gentlemen, are Christian. He just can't deal with this guy going the wrong direction here. But then most of the people on the boat, they're Burmese. And they are grinning, you know, fit to split their faces. because in Burmese culture, particularly then but still today, you don't do direct confrontation in the way that you do in Ireland. But it's fantastic for them to have an official representative of their religion who is prepared to be confrontational in the face, of course, of all these confrontational missionaries who are going around the place going, have you heard the good news about Jesus Christ? And Damaloka's like,
it's bad enough to see white Christians, but the man who swallows all the rot the Sahib missionaries dish up from when the true faith lies not a day's distance is disgusting. You should be ashamed of yourself.
And everybody gets this is not just about Christian salvation versus Buddhist enlightenment. This is about race. This is about power. This is about empire.
By Lawrence Carroll's transformation into Udamaloka garnered modest attention in the press. It was his bold actions in Burma and beyond that stirred unease within the empire, signalling a ripple of nervousness.
Frank's journey is in 1905. His book doesn't come out till 1910. Then Damaloka's name really goes round the world. Like, it turns up in the Sunday Independent here in Dublin and a shorter version in the Indo. You know, so if they're talking about this Irish Buddhist, you know, he's really quite a big deal. So Frank is one of two or three people who really make this story a world sensation. But there's a reason why it becomes a world sensation. The British Empire is a really, really fragile thing. It doesn't seem like it necessarily at the time, but they have had this uncomfortable little Indian uprising. And of course, actually, it's all going to fall apart in 1947, 1948. It's very big, it's very impressive, but there's also a lot of anxiety. There's two reasons for that anxiety. One reason is Ireland. So we're talking about an Irish radical between 1900 and 1913, 1914. We know what's going to happen in 1916 and then in the 1920s in Ireland. A lot of the guns that are pointed at Indians and Burmese and Malaysians and Singaporeans and Sri Lankans, they're held by the Irish. So there's this worry. What if the Irish in the British Army aren't going to be loyal anymore? So the Irish are a cause for anxiety. But Buddhism is too. And it connects up all of these colonized countries. And then the idea that these Buddhists who cut across British Empire might shake hands with the Irish who are holding the guns who keep the empire together. This anxiety about the Irish and the Buddhists is basically saying, look, empire is an incredibly complicated house of cards, and it wouldn't take much to knock the whole thing over. And of course, that is what happens, you know, a generation after Damaloka in all of these countries.
The two things people would know most about Burma, also called Myanmar, in an English-speaking audience is the genocide perpetrated by the Burmese military against the Rohingya ethnic minority who live on the border between, or live at the border between Myanmar and Bangladesh now. And then people would also know the coup perpetrated by the military in February of 2021 that overthrew a democratically elected government and returned Burma to military rule after a decade of hopeful democracy that had been there. The idea that the Rohingya are somehow separate or different from the rest of the Burmese is very much a product of British colonialism, because of course it's British colonialism that drew a strict boundary between what is now Burma and what is now Bangladesh. And British policy had ideas of religious hegemony, an idea that Burma was mostly or was really a Buddhist country, and that on the Bengal side, and what would become Bangladesh, was mostly a Muslim country. And that's the discourse that's been replicated later by Buddhist nationalists to say, if you're Muslims, if the Rohingya are Muslims, then they must be illegal migrants, that they don't belong here. They've snuck across the border. We saw a change when the coup happened. So I think many of us were shocked at seeing Buddhists supporting genocide, supporting anti-Muslim violence. We associate Buddhism as a religion of peace, and we associate Buddhism as a religion of tolerance. The military had been in power from 1962 until 2011, so it wasn't terribly shocking. This is what people knew, but the generation of students that had come up in that period that had had freedom of the press, had open access and public movements for social movements and these kind of things, responded really strongly against the military. What had been large movements of anti-Muslim chanting and organizations and things like that, after the coup changed pretty quickly. What we see are massive movements of people in the streets of Rangoon and all of the cities and villages across the country protesting against military rule and for democracy. But the thing we really see that's changed in that moment is whereas in the past these movements would have been dominated by the colors of Buddhism, Buddhist monks, pictures of the Buddha in the front of them, the images we get in the protests in the streets are much, much more pluralistic after 2021. And those people who have joined the revolution against the military coup that's happened right now in Burma and the revolution they're fighting at this moment is much, much more pluralist. The dominant view you would see, whereas in the past it had always been the saffron color of Buddhist monks, now what you see are interreligious and interfaith gatherings. And so we have iconic images of Christian nuns and Buddhist nuns and Hindu women and Muslim women together. We have iconic images of imams together with Buddhist monks, together with Mahayana Buddhist monks and Christian preachers. What's really interesting is this big change between this very idea that Buddhism is something that's fragile and has to be protected, to an idea that what needs to be protected is democracy and the community and belonging that people have within Burma. And that gets represented with this multi-ethnic, multi-religious imagery that we've seen since 2021.
Would the Reverend Udamaloka have made of the conflict between Buddhist nationalists in Burma and the Rohingya Muslim minorities?
It's very difficult to view the anti-Muslim violence in Burma and not understand who was in the minority and the subordinate position there. And I think he would definitely have been an advocate for the underdog. When I was watching the protests in 2021, I was strongly reminded of an event in Damaloka's life. When he is on trial for sedition, for preaching against the Christian missionaries, in Rangoon, we get a mass of movements who turn out in the same streets. So in the same streets where these protests happen in 2021, around the same pagodas, around the same markets, in 1911, we have the same protest happening on behalf of Damaloka. So they start where Damaloka's monastery is in the Chinese part of town. The Chinese markets all close down and people join them. They march through the area that's the Indian part of town. So we have Hindus and Muslims joining the procession to come all the way to the center of town. Along the way, they would have marched past the docks and the wharfs where we would have had sailors. Indians, Burmese of multiple different perspectives came together.
Turning to 1910, during the appeal hearing in Rangoon for his sedition trial, Udamaloka's destiny rested on the verdict of Daniel Toomey, an Irish resident judge serving under colonial powers.
In the chief court of Rangoon, so this is the centre of British justice, imperial justice in colonial Burma, and the judge there is this Daniel Toomey, Catholic, very well educated. You know, he's gone to a Jesuit college. And then there's this working class Irishman. And of course, they're both dressed up. You know, the judge in his wig, Damaloka with no hair at all. And they're facing off in the courtroom. One of the people supporting him in this is a very, very close ally of Gandhi, a guy called Pranjivan Mehta. And Mehta is on the radical wing of the Indian National Congress. So this is when Gandhi is boycotting British goods, yeah, when the whole civil disobedience campaign is really ramping up. So you can see why, you know, he likes the idea of Damaloka. He gets together with Damaloka's defender, who is later going to be a Burmese nationalist hero. So really the whole of this multi-ethnic colonized society is there, standing right behind Damaloka as he goes into the courtroom. Now, Damaloka's Irish, so he knows the value of a good trial. The judge is Irish as well, you know, and they're both obviously thinking very hard. So from the Empire's point of view, they cannot back down, right? They have to convict him. There is no way they can be seen to back down to the native mob. But they also can't make a martyr of him. That'd be a really, really bad idea. So they basically bind him over to keep the peace. I mean, that's a big win, you know, and Damaloka says so at the time. He's writing to his atheist friends in the States and he says, look, you know, this is really, you know, boosted.
My case has exercised a great store in Burma, but my reputation not suffered in the least by the prosecution. It, in fact, has given me a big boost in the eyes of the Burmese people and Buddhists in general.
When that term runs out after the year, he leaves Burma, and as far as we know, he never comes back. And the best sense we can make of that is that there are other kinds of threats conveyed, perhaps the kind that you don't find in the written record. What does Damaloka do? Well, he goes to Australia and he fakes his death. So this letter comes back saying, I run a hotel in Melbourne, and this strange Buddhist guy called Damaloka has just died here, and if anybody wants his effects, give me an address. It has to be written by Damaloka. You know, there's no other way of making sense of it. He's faking his death. Partly, perhaps, because there's a kind of extradition request. But then a couple of months later, he turns up at a newspaper office in Singapore and goes, I'm not dead. And he carries on around Singapore, what today is Malaysia, we think Thailand, he says Cambodia, we can't prove it. He's got these missions in Singapore, in Bangkok, in Penang, in present-day Malaysia. He's got some kind of base and connections. He talks to the guy who'd brought him over for that tour of Ceylon, and then he disappears.
For Brian Bocking, discovering a 120-year-old image of Damaloka was a rare glimpse that offered a confirmation of the existence of Lawrence Carroll, the Dubliner who became Damaloka and challenged the colonial authorities throughout Burma and across Asia.
I have to say, a high point of the research was not a story, it was a picture. We didn't know that there were any photographs of Damaloka. I remember giving a talk in about 2009, and I mentioned him and didn't know much about him, and I said, we haven't got a photograph of Damaloka, but we are going to find one. And I had no idea then how difficult it was for a photograph to survive for 120 years of someone who'd been forgotten. But as materials emerged online, and I got this article, it's a several page article, brilliant article. It's one of the most important sources we ever found, an article by a Canadian journalist. I downloaded it and I looked at it, and halfway through I could see there was a picture of Damaloka. When we first saw this photograph, it was like Damaloka sort of emerging out of the past, you know what I mean? He's like literally coming out of the shadows. And it was the most extraordinary, you know, we'd been studying this guy and we didn't have any picture of him, and then his face starts appearing, you know. And then we got the proper picture and you could see it was very clearly Damaloka. If we'd written our book and we didn't have any picture of Damaloka, it'd be a very different book. And it kind of proves this was a real person when you've got a picture of him.
How did Damaloka's legacy influence the twilight years of the British rule in Burma?
There are two ways that are direct. First of all, his trial for, we call it sedition, but actually it was tried under for creating enmity between Her Majesty's subjects, or maybe it was His Majesty's subjects at that point. So he was creating enmity between His Majesty's subjects. That trial is, and the case law that decides it, is what gets used for the sedition trials of a large number of Indian anti-colonial activists leading out from that. So his trial actually becomes the precedent that the government uses to try Indians of anti-colonial activities. His protests against Europeans wearing shoes at the Shwedagon Pagoda, that cause is central to how Burmese understand the end of British colonialism. I think he may have been a quiet inspiration to many, but not one that was ever explicitly said, this is why we're able to do this. One of the lawyers at his trial actually went on to become the sort of rock star nationalist organizer a decade later. So a lot of people sort of cut their teeth around him.
The last known sighting of Uda Maloka is said to have been 1914 in Singapore. But how much do we really know about how he lived out his final days?
Well, you'd partly love to imagine that he made up a whole new life for himself and that we've actually all heard of him under some totally different name. My best guess is that he probably died somewhere quite remote, presumably outside of Burma, where everybody would have gone, oh my God, Damaloka's dead. That's the easy thing. But you could imagine that, you know, those people who made threats caught up with him. You know, when the three of us sat down and looked at each other after, you know, spending 10 years each looking at him, I'd still say the same today. I think he was really consistent. I don't see him disrobing from being a monk. You know, I see him just carrying on to the bitter end.
Lawrence Carroll's Mindful Anarchy, Uda Maloka, the Irish Buddhist of Rangoon, was produced, edited and presented by Noel Sweeney. Assistant producer was Grainne McPolan. Dramatic reenactments were by Dylan McDonough, with main dialogue taken from research published in the book The Irish Buddhist, The Forgotten Monk Who Faced Down the British Empire. Script supervision was by Paul Cahill, with additional research by Lawrence Cox. This documentary was supported by a grant from Commission Na Mban as part of the Sound and Vision Scheme.